Welcome back to this second hour of Leading Edge Medicine. Leading Edge Medicine provides only general medical information. Since everyone's individual situation is unique, you should consult your own physician before taking any action related to your personal health. All content of this program is intended for general informational purposes only. Good morning and welcome to Leading Edge Medicine with Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat. Leading Edge Medicine is sponsored by Longevity Medical Clinics and is devoted to helping you feel and function better tomorrow than you do today by providing the newest and most advanced medical care designed to improve both your body and your brain. Leading Edge Medicine will keep you informed regarding the very latest developments in science and medicine while highlighting some of the Northwest's most prominent physicians. All while helping you separate the science from the silly and the facts from the fiction. This is live call-in radio at its very best, giving you the opportunity to participate in the show. Now, here are your hosts for Leading Edge Medicine, Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat, along with their co-host, Lynette Morgan.
With hour number two of Leading Edge Medicine, Lynette here. Good morning. Along with Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Michael Gilbert of Northwest Vision Institute. If you've got an eye question, have we got the doctor? And hopefully some good answers for you. I know that Lisa in Marysville has a question about some eyes. Welcome to the show, Lisa.
Good morning, Lisa.
Hello, Lisa.
Hi. Hi. Yeah, I've been calling in kind of in the past couple months. I'm the one who had the surgery on my lower eyelid for getting rid of basal cell carcinoma, and I've had it done now. The stitches are taken out as of last Tuesday. So I have it's right under my eyelash line, lower eyelash line, and I'm trying to get rid of the scar eventually. I know it takes time. So I'm getting conflicting information, and I don't want to put any, it's very close to my eye, even though it's not, you know, it's under the eyelash line. I've been hearing you could take a vitamin E capsule, poke it, you know, squeeze out the oil and put that on. That vitamin E in general is helpful for scars. Then I've also heard about clean white petroleum jelly. If it's, you know, a good one, you can put a little of that to keep the scar moist, as well as I've heard about silicone gel. But if either vitamin E oil, petroleum jelly or silicone gel, if I used any of those three for the scar line and a little bit gets in my eye, will that be harmful? I'm not trying to get it in my eye, but if a little
does. Understand.
So I hope Dr. Mixon will answer the biggest question of which of those would be the best for the scar. But your specific question is, any one of those preparations in small amount in the eye, is that likely to do any damage?
Yes.
And none of them that you mentioned would be a problem. I would try not to get it in your eye, but I don't think any one of those is going to be a problem if you got a little bit in. Just put in some artificial tears, wash it out, you should be fine.
Yeah, you might just see a film or something, right? Because I've gotten that in my eye, and it's like, whoa, weird, but not.
Yeah,
I don't like petroleum jelly on wounds, so scratch
it. You don't?
No. It keeps it moist, but it is petroleum, okay? It's basically oil, gasoline sort of stuff. The petroleum jelly is the gel that's left at the bottom of the barrel when they're doing the distillation process to make gasoline.
I didn't know that. And here, you put on.
He's trying to make it sound awful.
Well, it does.
It is awful.
You did a good job, Dr. Mixon.
It is awful.
Never use it again.
It's like fracking.
Yeah, that's right. I don't mind fracking because that's where we can get lithium now.
I know. Isn't that great?
Yeah.
Just makes me smile.
But, vitamin E is fine. Vitamin E isn't going to bother anything, and it is soothing. It doesn't decrease inflammation. It's a potent antioxidant. Works with vitamin C quite nicely. And the silicone gels are used to minimize scarring anywhere on the body. But I can tell you the one that I love most of all, in postmenopausal women and in men, is an estradiol cream. Estradiol is the primary human estrogen, and I have the compounding pharmacist put in estradiol in a vanishing cream, in a very, very light water-soluble vanishing cream, and apply that to a fresh surgical incision about twice a day, just very lightly rubbing it into the wound. And it knocks the scarring down to the point that you can hardly even see where there was an incision. Mm. I've had guys who had their chest cracked to do a coronary, you know, open heart coronary bypass grafting, and sometimes you can't even find the scar when they heal if they'll start putting the estrogen on right after. You know, estrogen is a very, very potent anti-inflammatory, and it decreases scarring dramatically. So men
now,
tend to make...
I couldn't get that, though, from because I'm not, I mean...
Yeah, you need a doctor to write the prescription.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. It is a prescription item.
And actually, the doctor that I went to, the oculoplastic surgeon, I mean, he's actually different than a lot of what I've read. Tons of what I've read has said you want to keep the scar moist, mm-hmm. that you'll heal better with a moist one than if it's just dried. He is saying you don't need to do anything. Don't put anything on it. Let it just go naturally. But everything I've read said otherwise. Yeah. And so then my dermatologist, who actually is the Mohs surgeon who took off the thing to start with, they tell people to put a thin layer of Aquaphor or Vaseline over it. And so I can't get anybody to write something for me. I hear what you're saying, but, and I don't like the idea of silicone just because, I don't know, just the stuff I hear about it, even though I'm reading, that helps. But for me, if I wanted to put a little bit of vitamin E oil then from a capsule,
that would be just fine.
Access, and just if a little gets in my eye, Dr. Gilbert, you're saying that, or the jelly, or the white petroleum jelly, or the silicone gel wouldn't be a big deal, and then just have, if it gets in, but I'll try not. But anyway, you're saying, though, Dr. Mixon, if far as the scarring, if I can't get a hold of what you're saying.
Vitamin E would be your choice. But also, kick your dose of vitamin C up orally. Don't put the vitamin C on the wound because it's acidic. But oral vitamin C.
And, how much would you recommend a day of the vitamin C? I usually do 1,000, but under this circumstance.
1,000 is fine. You can kick it up to 2,000.
I take the vitamin E orally also. Do you think that would be good at this time?
Yes.
Too?
See, vitamin C and vitamin C recharges vitamin E. Vitamin E, when it has its antioxidant effect, actually becomes reduced, and then it's recharged by vitamin C in the system. So it's a cycle. Those two work together. So plenty of oral vitamin C, and you want to take it 2 or 3 times a day, because it's water soluble. Your kidneys clear it. You pee out your vitamin C pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Okay. So take your vitamin C, say 3 times a day, and then put your vitamin E on. And that way, as the vitamin E gets used, the vitamin C will help to recharge the molecules and keep them active.
Okay. And what do you think of the silicone gel?
Well, again, I've never applied silicone gel to a fresh wound. But I see the silicone patches that they put on current scars after it's been healed for a month or so. People put that on, and it does seem to help prevent the hyperkeratotic scars, keeps the scar flat and smoother.
Oh, so does that go away eventually? That's one thing I'm already noticing. I've got these little bumpy, I guess probably what it is, they're little bumpiness across the incision. Will that flatten and go away anyway?
Probably. Again, I can't see the wound.
Yeah.
Remember, I'm the guy on the radio.
Yeah,
but
I know.
But what that often is if the doctor is doing subcutaneous stitches, he's putting some little stitches in down deep into the tissue to hold the wound together, to take the stress off the skin so that he gets a nice, pretty skin incision, you will often get little bumps from those deeper knots, and they will dissolve. They take usually about 2 or 3 months, but they'll dissolve and go away.
So yeah, and you know, the other thing is, I think he might have left some fragments. These are not dissolvable. These are the ones that, you know, you had to go get them taken out. And I think he left them in too long based on other things that I read. But then when he took it out, I thought I could still see some color there. And I said, well, what if there's still a little bit of fragments there? And he said, that's no big deal if a few fragments are left. Is that true?
What will happen is your body will reject them. They'll push out to the surface. And so they'll basically be expressed over the next several months, even if they're there.
Okay.
Excuse me. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, but it is best to keep stitches moist. That you agree with better than just dry.
I like to keep the wound clean and moist. Yes.
And again, just lastly, again, I heard what you said about the petroleum, but you know that about like millions, not millions, but
I know.
Several
lots
dermatologists,
of people,
they all recommend it.
I know. Well, and it is effective at keeping it moist. Okay? I just don't like the idea. I have not seen a study showing that the petroleum jelly is bad. It's just the idea of putting oil sludge on a fresh wound just rankles me. Especially when I've got things like estrogens that I know are anti-inflammatory, vitamin E that's anti-inflammatory, hell, Neosporin ointment, you know. You got all kinds of stuff you can use other than petroleum gel. That's all.
You know, the doctor gave me your erythromycin antibiotic ointment for the first week. I was supposed to do it for 7 days, and that I did. That was just before the stitches even came out, because he didn't take them out till like day 12.
Sure.
But anyway, when I look at the ingredients of that, you know, it's the erythromycin with mineral oil and petroleum jelly. That is
so
what
you can
made
use
of.
That.
Yeah.
Use that.
I understand.
Well, I have been using that, except for
good.
Antibiotic ointment. Wouldn't that be bad to continue for too long? I mean, because of the fact that there's the erythromycin in it.
Well, erythromycin we use for people with acne, and we keep them on it every day for years at a time. So,
so you're selecting for some resistant bacteria, but I don't think there's any argument that I don't think it matters.
No.
If I use that longer. Well, I only have a little tiny tube, and it's not
got
a refill on it. But I will do that, so that's good to know. But my point, though, is that has Vaseline. Or it's
I know.
Perfect.
I know. And like I said, I don't have a study that compares people with and without petroleum jelly against other things. It's just an emotional reaction on my part. I don't like putting oil sludge on my skin.
I know. Yeah, it's more of that.
Yeah, it's pretty skin. So
the takeaway is figure out a way to get estrogen, or it doesn't matter. The rest of the list is fine.
Yeah.
The rest, if it gets in the
estrogen
eyes,
sounds like it would be, I've made a note that if I get my next scar, I'm going to talk to Dr. Mixon because I am a longevity patient and get some estrogen cream.
There you go.
Yeah. And, you know,
Number one, avoid scars. Number two, if I get one.
You got it. And I had a little skin cancer removed from my right arm about a month and a half, 2 months ago. And so it was in one of my scars. I had an old gunshot wound that then I developed a little cancer in the scar from the gunshot wound. And I just grabbed some of my wife's estrogen.
There you go.
And rubbed it on there.
That was my thought, actually. Some of my wife's estrogen cream.
There you
I know there's a little she won't know.
She'll never know.
I went back to the dermatologist that did the excision 6 weeks later, and she could not find the scar.
Good. So, just don't put testosterone.
She wanted to know the trick.
Yeah, because a little hair might grow out of it.
All right.
Oh, Lisa, thank you so much. I'm so glad that your eye surgery went well for you.
As long as the scar goes away now. So, all right. Thank you so much for
Okay. Wow, lots of good information there. We are going to check in with one of our longtime listeners. He's had to talk to you about prostate cancer issues. Now we're going to find out a follow-up. John, hope you've got some good news for us. Calling in from Tacoma. Hi, John.
Good morning, guys. Hey, this is like you said, it's a continuing saga of John in Tacoma. Hey, just got my follow up. Got my first PSA done after the biopsy and all that stuff. The numbers have dropped one whole point. My original was 7.1, and this one is 6.0.
Good.
And the doctor didn't make any comment about the lower number, so I'm kind of wondering.
All right. Okay. So you want to know, hey, is that reassuring? Yeah. Yeah, it's reassuring.
Yeah,
it is reassuring, but it's not a guarantee of anything. Here's the problem. Nothing done to or by human beings is perfect, and that includes our laboratory testing. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
You can take the same blood sample from one person and run it in the same lab on the same equipment five times in a row.
On the same day.
On the same day, and you'll get probably three or four different values. All right. You don't get exactly the same value from the same blood sample on the same machine on the same day. There's always a variable in there. And so it's within a range. 1.1 is a bit wider than I would expect. But, you know, prostate cancers seldom go down in PSAs. Their typical is they continue to go up over time. So when I see a drop of more than one, that's reassuring. That tells me things are not growing like mad, at least, or they'd be going up. So whether it actually went down or stayed the same and we're seeing a little laboratory variation, I can't swear to it. But either way, if it were my prostate, I'd feel better about it. Okay, we got a break. So sit tight. We'll be back after the commercial. Okay.
Very good. Leading Edge Medicine will continue, and we have room for you. Get in the call queue. Here's that number to call. It's 800-465-8770. We'll be right back. Stones, they were just in Seattle recently, and Mick Jagger still going across the stage. I was not there. I had friends that were, and the whole band, I mean, wow.
And they're our age.
They're fermented,
quite
and they're
remarkable.
Still going and still singing and making music, and wow.
Different drugs probably now.
Yeah, probably so, but... start me up.
Now they're on their dementia drugs instead of their cocaine.
Still writing the best songs, I'm sure. Leading Edge Medicine.
Amazing.
Here we are, Dr. Jerry Mixon, Dr. Michael Gilbert. This is the day to call in with your questions about your eye health, or maybe a procedure coming up, or maybe a diagnosis of your eye that you're not really sure about. Dr. Michael Gilbert is here, and we'll be talking about eyes. Right now, John on the line with Dr. Mixon.
Hello, John.
Good morning. Yeah, you said to hang on, so.
Okay. Yes, we wanted to make sure we got all of your questions.
I just want to make sure, do you have any other questions about that, your testing or your prostate issue?
No, just it's still a hide and watch, another test in 6 months.
Okay, so. Good. All right, well, I'm glad your PSA is dropping.
Encouraging.
That's always encouraging. Okay. Keep hanging in there, brother.
And we like the updates because they're encouraging for other listeners listening going through that same thing. So, all right. Thank you for that, John. All right. We're headed to Monroe, and we have Richard on the line. Welcome to Leading Edge Medicine.
Morning, Richard.
Hello, Richard.
Hey, Dr. Gilbert. I have glaucoma, and my eye doctor says my optical nerve is degenerating, and he told me that there is a possibility of a surgery to put vents in my eye, and I was wondering what you thought about that.
Help me, a surgery to do what?
He said put vents.
Vents in your eye.
Just the glaucoma.
Okay, so we're talking about glaucoma. So primary care treatment of glaucoma, first step is generally laser. The laser treatments are probably superior to drops. Drops are effective. And there is a new class, relatively new, let's say over the last decade, there have been a number of new procedures that fall under a heading that, I love the name because it's called minimally invasive glaucoma surgery. We abbreviate it MIGS, but minimally invasive sounds pretty good, doesn't it? And the stent. So I think what they're talking about is the most common one is called an eye stent. It is the smallest stent that's used in the human body. It's incredibly small. It's titanium. And it's plugged into the drainage meshwork that's responsible for fluid outflow. The pressure inside the eye is determined by two factors. One is the pump. The pump cells don't have any kind of feedback. They don't know what the pressure is. So they just keep a pedaling and pumping fluid in and are totally insensitive to how high the pressure gets. So it's more primarily determined by the outflow. And the outflow is a meshwork that can get clogged over time or may be malformed in such a way that it doesn't allow it. So over time, and pressure tends to go up with age, so we can get to the point where it needs to be, the pressure needs to be lowered to protect that nerve. So I think that's the nerve damage that he's talking about related to that higher pressure. So it can be surgically reduced either by laser or if drops and laser aren't adequate, then the next step is the minimally invasive surgeries, lowest risk. Using the stent is one of those, and is effective, and we do it as well. So I think it sounds like it's reasonable. I'm assuming that you have been treated. You've been treated with some of the more conservative treatments first. Yeah, are you currently on drops?
Yes.
Yeah, I didn't understand that. Oh. Yes.
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Okay.
Very good. So if you're on drops and or have had the laser, and we still need to get lower pressure, then the next step would be one of the minimally invasive surgeries. Sometimes they're coupled with cataract surgery, and yet they can be used quite separately, independently of that, to help lower the pressure. So I think that's very reasonable.
And you do all that at your clinic?
I'm not fully under. Do we do these treatments? Yes.
Okay.
Yes, okay.
All right.
Dr. Mixon,
yes,
you
sir.
Are an enemy of fat. You don't like fat. But I've never heard you talk about liposuction.
All right. Liposuction is more for cosmesis. It's for help you to look better. And I'm less concerned about looks than I am with function. All right. I want you to be healthy. I don't really care about people's beach body if you fit into your shorts and stuff. I'm worried mostly about visceral fat, the fat that's inside under your abdominal muscles around your organs, because that's the fat that is dumping very potent inflammatory cytokines into your bloodstream and are raising your risk of diabetes and dementia and heart attacks and strokes and degenerative arthritis, all those really bad diseases of aging. And you don't get at that with liposuction. Okay? Mm-hmm. Liposuction is, you can do it on your thighs to make your thighs shapelier. You can do it on your tummy so that you have a flatter tummy. But none of that is getting at the fat that's going to kill you. The fat on your butt doesn't kill you. It just gives you a big fluffy butt. Okay? It's the fat inside your belly that scares me. Answer your question?
Well, would getting rid of the fat on your outside of your stomach help you lose the fat
inside?
Internally?
No, but I'll tell you what does help, and that we are now finding out, is the semaglutide and its relatives, the other new drugs for weight loss. You know, these were originally designed for diabetes, And what we found was diabetics that use these to lower their blood sugar started getting skinnier. And so people started using them off-label just for weight loss, and then the FDA finally came around years later and said, okay, looks like they do work for weight loss. Those do get rid of the intra-abdominal fat. They get rid of the visceral fat that I worry about. And now we're finding out that those medications not only lower blood sugar and decrease body fat and visceral fat, they actually improve cardiovascular function and lower the risk of heart attacks and strokes. So above and beyond the weight loss, they have a direct impact on your risk of cardiovascular disease. So I have been for the last 6 months giving those to my office staff as a freebie, just because, you know, I have to hire people from the Washington area and they all tend to be chubby. And I don't want a chubby office staff because we are a healthy clinic. I want my clinic to look healthy and be healthy. And so for the last 6 months, all of my employees that carry extra weight have been getting semaglutide on my nickel. I'm paying for it for them to lean up my staff and lower their risk of both diabetes, heart attacks, strokes, dementia, etc. So yes, I'm using the weight loss drugs for my own staff, but I'm doing it for their health, not for their looks.
But they are looking great, I must say.
They get a twofer.
Yeah.
Well, not only are they getting a twofer, they also it builds incredible employee loyalty.
Uh-huh.
You know.
Oh yeah.
I had one of the guys, not one of the ladies, but one of the guys who had struggled with weight all of his life, and he said, "Doctor, you got me as a staff member for the rest of my life. I'm not going anywhere ever." Because nobody else would give him
cared enough
free medication for his weight, you know, to actually help him get it down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So life-changing.
Yes.
Yes.
So rather than liposuction, I'd say go get semaglutide or one of the other related drugs. Use it. It'll decrease your appetite. It'll change your carbohydrate metabolism. It'll lower your risk of heart attacks and strokes and dementia. And it's a lot safer than liposuction. Okay?
I've been looking for your special, yes, and I have never seen it. Is it still going to happen, or did I miss it?
You've seen what? My what?
Your special on PBS?
Oh, the special. Oh.
You know what? That got canceled.
Oh.
Yeah, they decided I was too controversial.
Oh.
No.
Yeah.
Imagine that.
No.
Who would? What?
That's what I was afraid of.
Yeah, they were afraid I was too controversial to be on PBS.
Oh my gosh.
Man.
Well, you know, if you
don't think it's a matter of being controversial, I think you were just on the wrong side.
Perhaps.
No, he's on the right side, but yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Hey, Rick, thank you so much for your call. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back to talk more about the eyes in just a moment on Leading Edge Medicine. Stay right there. Center field. No, I'd rather be the catcher.
Yeah. All right.
I liked all the, you know, stuff.
And yeah.
Excitement at the...
I always enjoyed catching her.
Yeah. But, wait a minute. Yeah. We're talking baseball here, Dr. Mixon.
Baseball.
Yes.
Baseball.
Yes. Welcome back, Leading Edge Medicine. I'm Lynette and Dr. Jerry Mixon here. We also have Dr. Michael Gilbert from Northwest Vision Institute, our guest doctor in the studio. But you hear people say, you know, I am a patient of longevity. We hear some that have said, hey, we started since the very beginning. They're still here. They're still healthy. And that's what we want for you. We want you to, instead of saying, someday or maybe next, I'm thinking about it.
Yeah, some of my patients have been with us for 25 plus years.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's really kind of gratifying. I mean, people, they came to see me that were in their mid-50s, and now they're pushing 80.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they're still patients. Every few months, they're back in getting their evaluations and adjusting their levels. The purpose of Longevity Medical Clinic is to reverse all of those negative changes. You know, as you get older, if you look at pictures of you today and your pictures of you 30 years ago, you'll see a big change. And you didn't get better in the last 30 years. I mean, it just didn't happen.
I don't know. Some of us were nerds.
The reality is we can help you to age in a dramatically healthier manner.
Yes.
You can be stronger and faster and leaner and smarter mm-hmm. and sexier and dramatically happier than you were 20 and 30 years ago. It's just a matter of you got to get started. You got to quit fooling around and say the age is just a number. It is not.
No.
Aging is a harsh biological reality. Bad stuff is happening to you. And if you want to fix it, you're going to have to do more than put on a face cream or a lipstick or, you know, eat some special superfood. You actually need to rebuild as much as humanly possible the body that you used to have. And that means giving your body back the tools to work with. And the hormone balancing is the first part of that, but decreasing the inflammation, looking at your genome to see what your risk factors are, and customizing a program built just for you as an individual. And there's no standardized way to do this. You just have to deal with a doctor that specializes in this. And the best doctors that specialize in this field happen to work for me at Longevity Medical Clinic.
That's right.
Because we are the most experienced clinic of this sort. One of the best, or one of the longest serving in the country. You know, most of the people that started back when I started retired, quit long time ago. Mm-hmm. And we're still trucking along and innovating and changing things and helping you to be stronger, faster, leaner, smarter, sexier, happier than you've been in decades. So if you don't like what time and gravity is doing to you, if you don't like getting slow, fat, weak, dumb, and sexless, you probably ought to come on in to Longevity Medical Clinic and let us help you to overcome it.
There you go. And by taking the first step of making that call for the free health analysis appointment, you'll get in, you'll meet our staff, you'll see our facilities, and hopefully you'll become a patient here at Longevity.
That is the goal.
What you need to do is give us a call and schedule that health analysis. Here's that number. It's 866-86-YOUNG. That's 866-86-YOUNG. You can even go to our website, which is lmclinic.com. That's lmclinic.com. We hope to see you here. We would love to talk with you at Longevity Medical Clinics. We have three, Linwood, Tacoma, and our beautiful new facilities in Kirkland. Let's go to the phones. Headed south to Tacoma, we have Randall on the line. Thank you, Randall, for your patience.
Morning, Randall.
Good morning, people. What I have to say is one morning I woke up with a numb feeling on my cheek, and I thought, oh, man, am I having a stroke? I didn't do anything about it. I didn't go to the doctor. Eventually, it subsided over the week. This was more than a couple months ago. I have a slight tingling still on my cheek and a little bit on my left lip. Now, I did talk to my congestive heart failure clinic doctor. He gave me a CAT scan, and it showed that I did not have a stroke. He's thinking maybe it's something to do with nerves. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. Well, it obviously has to do with the facial nerve. You know, the facial nerve has three branches. One goes up and covers the eye and the forehead. One does the mid-range of the face, and one does the lower third of the face on each side. They come out right in front of your ear and branch off. We call it the trigeminal nerve. And you can get trauma or viral infections of that nerve. And one form of that is something we call Bell's palsy, where you get numbness and drooping of that side of your face that can last for months or years or be permanent. Or you could have a what we call a TIA, a transient ischemic attack, not a true stroke, where you don't kill the brain tissue, but where you shut down a part of the blood supply to a little piece of your brain, and then it opens back up, and the brain didn't, that part of the brain didn't die, it just kind of got insulted, and you normally recover from that fully over time. The problem is if you're throwing TIAs, if you're having these little kind of mini strokes that don't actually kill anything, your risk of having a full-scale stroke in the next 2 years is about 1 in 3. So we hope it's not a TIA. We hope it's just, you know, a viral issue with your trigeminal nerve. But, you know, clearly as the guy on the radio who can only hear a brief set of symptoms and not go through a real history and not do an evaluation and not running any nerve conduction studies or anything else. You know, I can make educated guesses, and that's about all I can do here on the radio.
So, right. He did suggest maybe Bell's palsy, and I did go back and see him again, and he's thinking it is not Bell's palsy. I don't know how he came up with that determination, but now the TIA, so it doesn't always show up on a scan.
No, it frequently does not because it's a very short term. You get a little clot that decreases the blood supply to part of the brain, and then the clot is dissolved. And once it's gone, it's gone. And now you do your scan, and it looks just fine.
I'm wondering now because I still have a little, it's like a numbness in my lip, not so bad on my cheek. So it's on the left side.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, you know, he's running some more tests, blood tests, and so he wants to do a scan of my brain again. I don't know what he's looking for, but I had a heart attack and bypass about 35 years ago.
Uh-huh. Well, and of course, it sounds like, too, you said you're congestive heart failure doctor. So
he's a congestive heart failure doctor.
So you've got some degree of failure, of heart failure.
Yeah, I have congestive heart failure. My output is down in the teens now. I'm 80 years old, but I'm doing really well. I can still walk around. I'll go out for my walk, you know, and things. And I don't need help with a crutch or anything else.
Sure.
You know?
But see, with poor cardiac output, it means you've got less blood flow. You're not pumping a lot of blood efficiently. And when blood flow is slow and sluggish, you're more prone to form clots. In order to keep these things from clotting, the blood's got to keep moving. And if it gets stagnant and slows down, then you can get in issues. So, you know, my guess, and once more, I'm just the guy on the radio, but my guess would be that you're at high risk of a TIA and or a real stroke, in part because of your old heart attack and now your congestive failure. You just don't have a great cardiac output.
No, I know. But I'm prepared. I made it to 80. I'm thinking, hey, you know, that's pretty good. But, okay.
It's a good start, my friend. But
there you go. You got lots of years left in you.
But it's only 3.5 years out for me because I turned 77 in August. So, you know.
Can I give one more question to Dr.
80 seems awfully close. Why not? Go ahead. He's sitting here being bored. You may as well put him over.
Dr. Gilbert, one morning here I woke up and one eye was really all red. I've never had that before in my life. And over the week, again, it subsided, and so it didn't have any pain. Is that something, did I lay on my hand or what? Is that anything to worry about?
I think it's, did you notice was there any change in comfort, any other symptoms?
Just a little itchiness, but it went away, you know, like scratchy feeling.
So
I'm not one to go to doctors if something's wrong.
A little difficult on the radio, but what it sounds like, most likely, I think it was probably just a small subconjunctival hemorrhage. Those are totally painless, mostly cosmetic, but depending on the size, it could resolve in a week if it were small. And especially with your cardiovascular history, you're on some cardiac meds, and are you taking an anticoagulant or any aspirin or anything like that?
Yes.
Okay, so that does not cause those hemorrhages. But what it does is if you get a micro hemorrhage or something that would have been very small, it makes it allows it to be larger and more visible. Oh. And those are painless, those are totally benign, have no impact on the health of the eye. So I think of them as largely cosmetic, probably was the way you slept, and would not be
okay,
a concern.
Good.
No concern.
Oh. Okay, you guys, thanks a lot. It reassures me about things. So,
okay.
Have a good one.
Have a wonderful day, sir. Enjoy the sunshine. Bye-bye.
Yes. All right. Had a couple of, on the same topic, a couple of texts come through, and they kind of relate. Linda wanted to know, is there any special diet for those people that are on semaglutide? Another question was, I'm on Ozempic. For 5 months, A1C is coming down. My Good. Weight is not. That might kind of go hand in hand.
Well, you can out-eat any diet.
Yes.
Well, you can, although usually the semaglutide and related drugs decrease appetite.
Mm-hmm.
The major side effects with those drugs is nausea.
Which will do
and
it, yeah.
If you're feeling pukey and queasy, you generally want to eat
it's
a
out.
Lot.
Yeah.
And so... abdominal cramping, diarrhea, or constipation. Constipation actually more frequently than diarrhea, and decreased appetite, just not feeling hungry at all. Mm-hmm. And that's really seems to be a big part of how they work.
Okay.
Caloric intake tends to plummet just because people don't feel like eating. But it also changes the way you metabolize your carbohydrates. It does change your glucose metabolism, too, and makes it less efficient. So the food you eat tends not to go to fat as well. So when I see somebody whose A1C is coming down, obviously they're getting a result from their glucose. Weight is not coming down. Okay, I can think of a couple of possibilities. One is there fluid retention?
Mm.
Okay. And for that, I'd want a lot more history. I want to know more about, you know, their cardiovascular history. How old are they? How much salt do they take in? Do they get puffiness in their ankles or are their fingers swollen in the morning? You know, can they wear their rings to bed? The rings are loose in the daytime. Like my wedding ring is sliding on and off quickly. But in the morning, I can barely get it off.
Oh.
You know, and I take it off to shave because I get the shaving cream and stuff underneath it and it irritates me. So, but just that fluid shift, you can get several pounds of fluid shift just overnight, depending on what's going on. So, and physical activity. Are they coupling their exercise with their diet? If they're doing anaerobic activities to build muscle, are you doing planks or push-ups or sit-ups or that sort of thing? Because muscle is very, very heavy. And people will find that their blood sugar is dropping, their pants are fitting better, their waist is more slender, but there's no pound dropping. And that's because muscle mass.
Oh.
One cubic centimeter of muscle weighs as much as 5 cubic centimeters of fat. Okay. So you can add a little bit of muscle, lose a fair bit of fat, and the weight doesn't change at all. But you're leaner because the muscle doesn't take as much space. So there's a lot of possibilities there. It could be fluid shifts. It could be dietary. It could be exercise related.
All right. And eating the right things, right? She was wanting to know if there was a special diet if you're on Ozempic.
Well, and we have a variety of diets we use with our patients, and it depends on the patient. Yes. So for a lot of people, we don't have to give them any special diet. If they're losing weight and they're feeling good and they're having no adverse effects, we just say, keep going, you know, keep on doing what you're doing. But some folks, we want to make sure that they're getting adequate carbs. other folks, if they're trying to make some muscle, they're trying to get in shape. They're not just trying to lose fat. They actually want to, quote, get in shape. Mm-hmm. Then we increase their protein load a bit. We may put them on amino acid supplements of some sort. Other people, especially if they are diabetic, we don't want to crash their sugar too low, too fast.
Oh, okay.
And so we may actually ask those people to snack a little bit with some carbs. But we also, on those people, we put them on a 24-hour glucose monitor, continuous glucose monitor, so that they, on their cell phone, are getting a continuous readout of what their blood sugar is, and it's being graphed through the day. And they can see exactly what their blood sugars are doing so that we never get them in trouble.
Okay.
And I'm a big fan of those blood sugar monitors, especially for people that are pre-diabetic or type 2 diabetic. I think they should all be wearing a glucose monitor all the time.
All the time. And a lot of them for diabetics can be prescribed.
Yes.
And covered with insurance.
Yes, insurance will cover them for many people. But even for folks that are not truly diabetic, that just want to follow their sugars, you can get versions that are not terribly expensive. I mean, $100 or so. Yeah. You're going to spend probably another $100 a month on the sensors because you change those periodically. Mm-hmm. But, it's a lot less than going to Starbucks daily.
Yes. Uh-oh. He saw my Starbucks cup. I only do that on Saturdays.
Honest.
Okay. All right. Oh, hopefully that was a good help for our two callers, texters, inners. We're going to head to Kirkland. We have Rick on the line with a question for the doctors. Welcome to Leading Edge Medicine.
Morning, Rick.
Hi. My primary care physician has suggested that I go on rosuvastatin to lower my cholesterol count, and I've heard that statins can cross the blood-brain barrier and thereby also reduce the cholesterol in your brain, mm-hmm. Which can lead to reduced cognitive function over time.
Yep.
I'd like to know what you think about that.
It happens with some people, yeah. Cholesterol is not bad. Cholesterol is critically important for life. Cholesterol metabolism is important for brain function, muscle function, bone production, your heart, your lungs. They all require cholesterol. And cholesterol is also the mother hormone. All the other hormones, pregnenolone, progesterone, dehydroepiandrosterone, testosterone, estradiol, cortisol, these are all made out of cholesterol. So when we take a drug that interferes with cholesterol metabolism, we are interfering with body functions body-wide, from your brain right down to your toenails. Some people tolerate that just fine, but some people really get symptomatic. Some folks get muscle weakness and aching and pain. Some folks get memory issues and fuzzy-headed, and they can't concentrate. So, if you have no adverse symptoms, go for it. I have no problems with your being on a statin, but if you're having any sort of symptoms, then I like to do some alternatives. One of the things we found through the decades is we're able to lower cholesterol to very nice levels in the vast majority of our patients without statins. Maybe 5% of our people need a statin. And so we use them, but we use them very rarely. What we're finding is that because cholesterol is that mother hormone, as you're aging, the end organs, the adrenal glands, the ovaries in women, the testicles in men, all of these glands are becoming old and fragile, and they're not working as well anymore. So all of those hormones made out of cholesterol start to decline, and you have less and less of all of them. And your body recognizes you have a deficiency. You have a wide-based hormonal deficiency. And so you start ratcheting up your cholesterol production in an effort to drive those end reactions. If you're not having enough testosterone, pregnenolone, dehydroepiandrosterone, cortisol, and so on. So your body raises cholesterol in an effort to drive those downstream reactions. But you can't work. It doesn't work because the end organs are old and failing, and they're just not able to use the cholesterol to make the hormones you're supposed to have. What we're finding is when we give you back all of those hormones, all of a sudden your cholesterol becomes very easy to control because you don't have that feedback loop anymore. Now, all of a sudden, your body is saying, oh, I've got all of the stuff I need. I don't need more cholesterol. So now when we tighten up your diet, we put you on a little exercise, all of a sudden your cholesterol falls and it goes down to where we want it. So most of the time that works very, very nicely for us. On the other hand, there are people that are just genetically coded. Their family always runs high cholesterols. Well, that person, we may need to use a statin. But that's about 5% of our patient load. Does that answer your question?
That's helpful. The one question is, if the effect on your cognitive function, on your brain, mm-hmm. is very gradual and you know, slow to develop,
yep.
I mean, how would you know? If it's happening very gradually and incrementally, how are you going to know that before it? I don't want to wait until some serious damage has been done to my cognitive function before I realize that I shouldn't have been taking the dang things.
Yes. Well, the good news is that what we have noticed is if people are developing cognitive slowdown, if we take them off their statins, their brain suddenly perks right back up within a week or two. So it doesn't seem to be a permanent damage. Okay. But the only way you're going to know for sure is to do testing. And, you know, in our patients, we will offer cognitive testing to our patients, anybody who wants it. We'll test them every year if they want it. Because we like to know if we're making, remember I told you stronger, faster, leaner, smarter, and sexier? Okay. I like to test our people up front, and then I like to test them periodically to make sure we're actually making them smarter over time. So, you know, in our patients, it's not an issue. They want to know, we'll find out. We do the test.
Okay.
I can't speak for your doctor. So. All right.
Okay.
I think we're losing.
Yeah, I think we're losing him.
All right. Yep. A little.
So it's a little unfair because it's related, but not very.
Uh-huh.
Really interesting. Just this morning as I was scanning iHeadlines, there's a meta-analysis that's in print, which means they don't have the details, but they let out the abstract. Meta-analysis of 24 studies published over the last 5 to 10 years, I think it was 5 years, showed a 25% decline for patients who had cataract surgery, 25% decline in the incidence of dementia and cognitive decline. But if you waited until you had the decline...
Oh.
And when you said you stop the statin and it comes back, if you wait until you have the decline, they did not see an improvement with cataract surgery.
That's fascinating.
Now, I've seen patients who appeared to have dementia. After cataract surgery, suddenly their activity and their mentation appeared to greatly change. So I think it's individual, but they said in the study, yeah.
Well, you know, that's been reported with hearing loss too.
Yeah.
Older people.
Sensory input.
Yes. If you lose your hearing, if you lose your vision, if you lose any of your sensory input, then your cognition tends to slow down with it.
Right.
So, you know, the goal, of course, is to stay as healthy as possible and to keep the variety of your sensory input. You know, if you're sitting home watching TV or reading the computer all the time, you're not likely to do as well as if you're out, you know, riding your bicycle and jogging down the street and talking to people and having interactions, you know, getting chased by dogs and chasing girls. And
chasing. Wait a minute. Making a note, chase.
Yeah. Chasing. Sorry. Okay. Sorry. Wow.
But yeah, anything you can do to stay active
moving
mentally and physically. That's the goal.
This is good. All right. That's it. That's our show for today.
Where did it go?
Where did it go? Thank you so much, Dr. Michael Gilbert, for coming in today.
Oh, my joy.
Northwest Vision Institute. If you'd like to contact Dr. Gilbert and his team, here's the number, and it's kind of clever. 425-450-2020. That's 425-450-2020. Dr. Jerry Mixon, we're going to be back next week, aren't we?
Sure.
Yes, let's do this
again. Why don't
we
do this again?
Yes, yeah. Father's Day weekend, we will be here with Dr. Umat as well. Have a great rest of your weekend, and we'll see you next time. Thank you for listening to Leading Edge Medicine.